But I want to thank Mike, who's right here.
As it turns out, Father Petcash and Carl Ertl for inviting me to come and speak with you. I didn't know about the First Friday Club of Greater Akron, and I looked at the list of speakers that you have, and it's really such an impressive thing. So it's an honor for me to be here with you. And also I'm glad that Don mentioned that I was a free safety. Just in the last 2 days, I had two people say, "Were you a lineman?" And they found out I was playing in college, which happens to me a little too often. And all of you guys who are over 50, you know what's going on there. But you know, I'm from the Detroit and Chicago province of the Jesuits, and I was ordained in Cleveland by Bishop Lennon, who I think is speaking next month. So it's good to be back home again. I saw the guys from Detroit province and up at Manresa on Labor Day, and it's good to be back here in Cleveland. Although I decided to take my talents to Seattle. Okay. All right. There it goes. So that was part of my punchline that didn't work. Taking my talents to Seattle, just to remind you what I said. But it's wonderful, and Don, if you could hit that, wonderful to be back home again. Not that I'm comparing myself to anyone else. But I know we got a couple tables of kids at LeBron's alma mater. And it was, I will confess that I did take a couple minutes, more than a couple, during my 8-day retreat to watch the final game. And I was really moved by it, you know, and maybe we can talk about this later. It seemed we were talking at dinner last night. It's almost like LeBron James sort of willed this reality into existence, but it had a deeper, to me anyway, it seemed to have a deeper meaning because it had to do with home, being home, no? And that kind of inspiration. So congratulations. Big moment for Cleveland, for this area. So I grew up playing sports and CYO leagues, Catholic school league. That was just my passion. You know, maybe some of the young people understand that. We all have different things that we enjoy. For me, that was my passion. And then I played football in college, as Don said. And then in college, I was raised Catholic, but in college, my faith life started to come alive in a new way. And I think after I was done playing college football through my 20s, I started to think that I should put behind me all of those childish things. Like St. Paul says, when I became a man, I was about the things of, and I put behind me childish things. And there was something in my thinking that I thought maybe I should put the sports behind me. Now that I was interested in spiritual things, let all that stuff having to do with the body and passion and play go. But I discovered over time that didn't work for me, mainly because I was so profoundly shaped by my participation in sport as a human being, both for good and maybe in some ways in not such a great way. And that human formation that I experienced was impacting my attempts to live the Christian life in my 20s. And so it was actually after I entered the Jesuits and did the spiritual exercises retreat that there was the invitation, it seemed, to reconnect with all of those human experiences. And then I've been doing ministry in areas connected to sport ever since then. But when I started my studies, especially doctoral studies, I had this question on my mind. What would a Catholic take on sport be? No? I realize we might not all be Catholics, but I was coming out of that, I'm coming out of that tradition, and that was a question for me, because there had been a lot written about Protestants in sport, but nothing really written about Catholics in sport. And I wasn't really convinced by, if you could, I wasn't convinced by what I was reading in terms of the way things were characterized, because I had studied theology now enough to know what, you know, about Christian theology. And what I was reading was a lot of things in the history of sport that were saying Christians loathe the flesh, you know, have a negative view of the body, and therefore not much really happened, like, say, you know, prior to modern world. And that you see this in this quote here: early Christianity gradually built a foundation based on asceticism, belief that evil exists in the body. Nothing could have been more damning for the promotion of active recreation and sport. So, but one of the reasons why this didn't wasn't persuasive to me is because we know, based on the study of social history, that people during the medieval period, for example, were playing games and sports throughout the year on feast days and holy days. We know this to be the case. And you could switch it to the... In some case, so that's, they had, by the way, 130, say, feast days during a typical year, so that's a lot of playing. And the games were at times depicted on religious art. This is a stained glass window in Gloucester Cathedral in England with a man with a stick and a ball. And maybe we could go to the next one. This is a seat. They call it a mercy seat, because it was where the monks would chant the office, and they had to stand, and some of them were older, so they had these seats that you could lift up and sort of sit while you're standing. And underneath the seats, they had depictions of these different activities, such as this ball game, and then a wrestling match. They had many other such depictions as well. And here's a prayer book from France in 1300 with depiction again of people playing ball at the bottom, and again to the next one. So I could show you many. We could spend the whole time I just showing you these slides, but just to give you a sense. So yeah, I hope you see what's happening here. These are religious works of art, and people are depicting people at play in these religious works of art, indicating that at least for the people who made them and then used them, that there wasn't a conflict between their religious faith and their participating in play and sport. So I started to wonder, you know, why is that? How did they think about the human person that led to a culture, religious culture, where play and games are so much a part of the activities? So if we could go to the next slide. I think one of the first things that's important is how Christians understood the human person, and maybe the next. But this is also related to how they understood the material world in general. So, I don't know if some of you know that in the early Christian church, there were arguments against these groups called the Gnostics and the Manichaeans. And the arguments had to do with how do we understand the material world in which we live. And the Christians were arguing emphatically that the material world is good because it's created by God. You know? And that also impacted how they thought about the human person and the body, that the body was integral to what it means to be a human being as created by God. So the ways that they'd often use is unity, that the person's a unity of body, say mind and spirit, or body and soul. You see this in Irenaeus' quote: "Christians hope for the salvation of the whole person, that is, of soul and body." He's writing against the Gnostics, who thought that resurrection had to do with the soul but not the body. He said, no, Christians hope for the salvation of the whole person. So this actually led to the development of a religious culture where bodily activities were also considered spiritual activities. If you think of processions, pilgrimages, sacraments, religious drama, it's a very, I don't know if you've taken trips to Europe, it's try to get a sense of what medieval Christianity, even later periods, a very bodily sort of religion. Then the other thing that I think was important was the way Christians understood virtue, believe it or not. And here Thomas Aquinas and others drew on Aristotle, who thought that virtue had to do with moderation, so we shouldn't do things in excess. including work. So Thomas Aquinas asks, can there be a virtue about games? And he says yes, because basically we shouldn't be working all the time. This would be excessive. And any human, fully human life needs time for relaxation and recreation. And so, yes, there can be a virtue about time for play and recreation. Now, he also asks another question later on, can there be sin in a lack of play? And he says yes, but for the same reason, no? Because that means you're being excessive in some sort of way. Now, I've been ordained for quite a while now, 17 years. I've never heard a person come into the sacrament of reconciliation and say, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I have not played in 3 months. No? This is not the way we think about sin today. But it's part of the tradition to recognize that a fully human life needs elements of play and enjoyment. So Thomas goes even further, actually, and compares play to contemplation, which because he says contemplation and play are both enjoyable, and we do them for their own sake. So he's connecting, he sees it to have a kind of spiritual significance. Now the Jesuits, and also the humanists during the Renaissance, were drawing on this tradition. They were influenced by Aquinas, this way of understanding things. And so they incorporated time for play and sport in the school day for kids, saying the kids should not be studying all the time. That would be excessive. But they also need time, especially because they're younger and they have a lot of energy, need time for play and movement. This is built right into the Jesuit Ratio Studiorum. A nice balance should be maintained between study time and recreation periods. So I'm kind of going through this quickly, I realize, because I want to get to the next part and then have time for discussions. But if you have questions, we can talk about it. But I think this approach, as I studied things, influenced Catholics in general when they came to the United States in terms of, right from the start, Catholics were, and in Jesuit schools and other schools, they had playing fields, they had time set aside for kids to participate in play and sport. The people who write the history of sport in general would characterize things as Christians, all of a sudden, they had developed an attitude, if you can't lick them, join them, and so they joined with the secular world. But that, I don't think that's accurate. I think that the Catholic approach was grounded in this longer tradition. So, what does this tradition teach us? A couple things. If the person is a unity, let's say body, mind, spirit, small letter S spirit is that dimension of the person that makes us capable of relationship with capital letter S spirit, with God, okay? If a human person is a unity of body, mind, and spirit, then the things that we engage in bodily activities affect our mind, our consciousness, you know, our thinking, gives us insights maybe, but also can affect us at that level of spirit, small letter S, you know, where we're in relationship or not, you know, close to relationship with God. If we're a unity, the things we do bodily affect us at those levels. But the other thing that's significant from the tradition is that play, sport itself is important. It has its own meaning. And so for the rest of the talk, we'll be considering how does play or sport participation affect the minds, you know, or spirits of the people who are participating? How is it that happens? And we're going to be doing that by paying attention to the experience itself of participating in sport. The best resource I found to understand that is the work of a psychologist. You can go to the next one. Named Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. I won't ask you to pronounce his name later, but and I was lucky to do my doctoral studies with him at Claremont Graduate University. So he came up with something that he calls the flow theory. And he became interested in play originally because when he was in doctoral studies, he was studying painters. And so he started off studying creativity. And he noticed that even though these people he was studying in Chicago, these painters weren't likely to make a lot of money or become famous as a result of their work, painting, they were completely immersed in what they were doing, you know, and they thoroughly enjoyed it. And they loved to talk about the subtleties and nuances of their craft. And it was this intrigued him, and he realized that psychology didn't have a way of accounting for this at the time, right? If you think of something like B.F. Skinner and behaviorism, it's all about the reward at the end. But they seemed to be really engaged in what it is they were doing. So he became interested in finding out, what is this enjoyment? What is enjoyment? And so in his first book, he studied people who were engaged in autotelic activities. This word comes from two words, auto, self, and telos, which means goal. And an autotelic activity, then, is an activity that has its goal or purpose within itself. Here's a quote from a composer. One doesn't do it for the money. This is what I tell my students. Don't expect to make money. Don't expect fame or a pat on the back. Don't expect a darn thing. Do it because you love it. This is an expression of the autotelic mentality. So one of the things that he discovered was, and one more photo, that there was a difference between pleasure, experiences of pleasure, and experiences of enjoyment. Experiences of pleasure we can get without investing ourselves in a significant way. If you go out and buy a carton of Ben & Jerry's ice cream today, you know, later on today, as long as you have a couple dollars, a spoon, you can eat that Ben & Jerry's ice cream in front of the television. It's going to be a pleasurable experience. But it doesn't require much of you. Enjoyment, on the other hand, he was discovering, happens when people put the whole of themselves into an activity and go beyond where they were in some domain or another. Let's see here. For example, he says, playing a close game of tennis that stretches one's ability is enjoyable, as is reading a book that reveals things in a new light, as is having a conversation that leads us to express ideas we didn't know we had. In all cases, kind of pushing the envelope. After those kind of experiences, we tend to say, that was really fun. No, that was enjoyable. And we usually want to do it again, too. So enjoyment happens when we put the whole of ourselves into an activity. Maybe to the next one. So characteristics of full experiences, then. One of the things he mentions is this one-pointedness of mind. When we're engaged in flow experience, we center our attention on a limited stimulus field. So in the case of sports, here's a quote from John Brody, played for the 49ers. I'll reveal my generation here. A player's effectiveness is directly related to his ability to be right there doing that thing in the moment. He can't be worrying about the past or the future or the crowd or some extraneous event. He must be able to respond in the here and now. You know? So fully present to what it is that you're doing, people describe when they're experiencing flow. So another way he describes it is that there's a merging of action and awareness. So what I'm doing and what I'm thinking about are one and the same if I'm experiencing flow. What I'm doing and what I'm thinking about merge, they come together. It's very different from much of the rest of life. A lot of times we're in one place, but our mind is somewhere completely different. But in a flow experience, a challenging activity, we're completely present to what it is we're doing, these two come together. You might know that the Buddhists call this mindfulness. So another thing that he says happens is that when we're in a flow experience, we don't think explicitly about ourselves like we often do in life. You know, if you think some of the high school students, you know, if you go to a party, sometimes you're wondering, oh, should I have worn this, or oh, I shouldn't have said that. We're kind of explicitly focused on ourselves. But when we're experiencing this flow and we're completely immersed in what we're doing, all of our attention is directed to the task at hand. We don't have attention left over to also be thinking about ourselves. You know? So this girl, as she's bringing the ball up the court, let's say it's the end of a close game, she has so many things on her mind. What's the score? How much time is left? Who has the hot hand on my team? What is the defense that they're playing? Did the coach call the play? She has so many things on her mind that she can't also be thinking about, I wonder what my dad thinks about how I'm playing, or if we win, will we be popular? She can't think about herself, too, right? So there's a kind of egolessness. This is an interesting point to me, because I think sometimes people criticize athletes or sports as being ego-driven, egocentric. But if this is true, actually when you're playing at the highest level, you're not thinking about yourself at all. You're completely immersed in what it is you're doing. Now, when I was first ordained, I was in a parish in Detroit for a year. And I was really enjoying it. I was experiencing a lot of things we're talking about, this one pointedness of mine, especially celebrating the liturgy, you know. And I would pray, obviously, before the liturgy and try to get a sense of what God is doing. How can I say something that's meaningful to the community, what's happening in the community, really enjoying the experience. And then one day, my friend came from London, who was studying, my novice classmate, he was studying theology there, and he was sitting in the fifth row of the parish. And I was walking down doing my homily, and about halfway through the homily, I started to wonder, I wonder what Ben thinks about my homily, you know? Must be kind of impressed with his former classmate. Or is he, you know? And So I think the laughter indicates we realize this is not a good development for public speaking. And the reason it's not is because I've gone to explicitly thinking about myself, right? And that happens when somebody comes in and then you try to put yourself in their shoes and wonder what they think about you. Here's a quote from St. Anthony from the 4th century, a monk, famous monk. A monk is not perfect if he's aware of himself or the fact that he's praying. And here's a quote from a Zen master. A peaceful life is to forget yourself completely and be who you are. I think they're both kind of capturing something of this. You know, they're trying to articulate something about this sort of experience. Okay, the next one. So while we're not thinking about ourselves explicitly during a flow experience, afterwards, actually, when we have attention to do so, often people describe they have a richer sense of themselves, that maybe aware of their own gifts, how they're connected to the community around them. So Csikszentmihalyi says, when we're not preoccupied with ourselves, we actually have a chance to expand the concept of who we are. Loss of self-consciousness can lead to self-transcendence, to a feeling that the boundaries of our being have been pushed forward. You know? I don't know if any of you have experienced that. You know, when you've been completely involved in something, completely self-forgetful, but then you have a sense that you've somehow, your life has been enriched in some way. And then in team sports, I think the flip side of egolessness is sense of union with the team. I'm a part of something that's larger than myself. So Phil Jackson, former Lakers coach, says, the struggle every group leader faces is how to get members of the team who are driven by the quest for individual glory to give themselves over wholeheartedly to the group effort. In other words, how to teach them selflessness. You know? And the next one. And I think we know that, especially those of us who are, you know, no longer in high school, a little bit older, that those relationships we form with kids, you know, playing and when we're in CYO or high school, those can last a lifetime, as they have for LeBron and his teammates at St. Mary's, St. Vincent. So they become crucial things. I know for me, I was telling the Wall students this morning, there were about 12 former players at my ordination here in Cleveland and at the dinner. And just Friday night, I was over with our quarterback and center watching the Michigan State game. So those relationships do last a long time. And then another thing about flow is that there's a kind of ease to it, people say, even though they're very much immersed in what it is they're doing. So the ease or effortlessness of flow is preceded by discipline, actually. Right? So if you think of if a girl in the seventh grade is right-handed and she's trying to learn how to shoot a left-handed layup, she has to initially think a lot about what did the coach say about what foot I have to jump off of. She has to practice over the course of a long period of time, you know, and in a disciplined sort of way. But then over time, let's say she gets in the ninth grade and she gets a pass on a breakaway and she shoots that left-handed layup like it's, you know, she's been doing it her whole life, like a, if there's a kind of ease or effortlessness to it. There's a woman here, a female runner, says, "You're going faster and yet it seems easier. It's hard to describe in words unless you experience it. You're going as fast as you can go and yet you're doing it quite easily," she says. And then time flies when you're having fun. That's what a lot of people say about flow. So time is experienced in a different way than, you know, on our clocks, every second is just like the last second, secularized kind of way of experiencing time. But during flow experiences, 60 minutes can go by in what seems like 10 minutes. I don't know if you guys or others, when I was growing up, I'd go down and play basketball down at the schoolyard, and I would like forget to come home and eat lunch. It was just like, you know, it was so much fun. Time went by very fast. So on the other hand, for some people, time slows down. So when they're experiencing flows, so it's people experience that differently. Now, sports, of course, are structured in such a way to put us in a different way of experiencing time. This is the Quicken Loans Arena, right? So it's, if this is a game of the Cavaliers, it's not only Tuesday night at 8:30, but actually the more important time is that there are 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter, you know. So when we place games in sports, we actually put ourselves into a context where we're experiencing time in a different way. Now, in a Christian context, we do that too with the liturgical calendar, right? So I can't remember the day that Easter was this year, but whatever that day was not like every other Sunday for Christians, right? We mark time in a different way according to the events of salvation history, and we experience time in a different way in that regard. So, characteristics of flow activities. Csikszentmihalyi says, we tend to experience flow when we're engaged in challenging activities that require skills. So you see here, the skill when my skill level is about the same as the challenges, that's when activity is enjoyable. We had a ping pong table in my basement when I was growing up, and the most enjoyable games were the ones with the longest volleys. Why? Because the two players are evenly matched and they keep stretching the other. It's really fun, and that's what this graph illustrates as well. I was saying earlier to the Wall students, I'll say now to the St. Mary St. Vincent students, if the football team for St. Mary St. Vincent played a CYO team, the varsity team for St. Mary St. Vincent next week, your skill level's way over here, and the challenge that the CYO team presents you is very small, so you'll probably be pretty bored, especially once the score starts getting run up. The kids on the CYO team, on the other hand, because you're presenting them with a challenge that's very high and their skill level isn't quite that high, are going to be anxious and could become overwhelmed by the game. On the other hand, when you're playing a team that you're evenly matched against, both teams can experience a kind of, you know, just a very exhilarating sort of experience. And then another thing he says about flow activities is that they tend to have clear goals and immediate feedback. And one more. Except, of course, they need to be age-appropriate, not like this fellow here. Okay. So then, Christian spirituality. In the middle of St. Ignatius's spiritual exercises, he has a meditation called the Two Standards Meditation, which is considered a key meditation in the exercises. And in that meditation, Ignatius says that people in societies tend to get off track when they become ensnared by riches, honor, which leads to pride, kind of sense that, you know, I'm better than the rest of you. Here's what I'm seeing. Remember that composer? He said, don't expect money. Don't expect fame. Don't expect a darn thing. Do it because you love it. To me, he's a person that's free of this. Ignatius says this is a way when he uses the word ensnared, we're not free. Because we start to think our you know, value, worth is in our what we own or what other people think about us. So experiencing flow is, I think, it's so rich because we're free of those things, and we're able to experience the internal meaning of what it is we're doing, you know, and the significance of it. Okay. Now, Phil Jackson thinks, by the way, so he's the most successful professional coach maybe of all time in any sport, certainly of basketball. So this is somebody coaching at the highest levels. He says, whether they're willing to acknowledge it or not, what drives most basketball players is not the money or the adulation, but their love of the game. They live for moments when they can lose themselves completely in the action and experience the pure joy of competition. One of the main jobs of a coach is to reawaken that spirit. Very interesting. He's saying one of the main jobs of a coach is to reawaken that spirit, the love of the game that was the initial motivation to play. Now these are, I'm going to talk a little bit about Ignatian spirituality now. I don't know if people are familiar with this, you know. If not, we can talk about it, or just take what you need from this talk and leave the rest, kind of. So Ignatius of Loyola has this term he calls spiritual consolation. And he uses this term to describe the life of a person who's trying to grow. Okay, probably all of us. You know, we're trying to grow in our Christian life. In the life of that kind of person, he says it's characteristic to experience God's presence in this way, spiritual consolation. And for him, this is related to the growth of the person. So he says, the good angel acts for the progress of the soul, that it may grow and rise from what is good to what is better. If you think flow is also related to the growth of the person. And then, so I think there are analogies, so the similarities and differences between consolation and flow. One of them is that it's characteristic of God to give genuine happiness and spiritual joy. Right? As with flow, experience of enjoyment, God, according to Ignatius, is characteristic for God, life of a person who's going from good to better, to give genuine happiness and spiritual joy. If you think of some quotations, this is actually, if you just pay attention to Pope Francis, he's talking a lot about joy. But in the Gospel, John's Gospel, Jesus says, I tell you these things to remain in God's love, so that my joy may be in you, and your joy may be complete. And from a Christian perspective, even our sufferings don't extinguish joy. A little later in John chapter 17, Jesus says, you grieve now because he's soon to die, but you will rejoice. I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy away from you. Next one. So, also the way Ignatius describes the action of God in the life of a person who's trying to grow is that there's a kind of ease to it, a kind of gentleness to it. He says, it's like, it's gentle and easy, the action of God in the person, like water falling into a sponge. Or he says, it feels like you're coming into your own house through an open door. You know? But, as with flow, this is preceded by discipline for Ignatius. So you have to in the spiritual exercises, you have a lot of things you have to reflect on. You pray, you have to get to know who Jesus is. So you have to have a life of discipline, prayer, commitment to God. But then over time, it starts to become an easy thing, a sense of God's presence. We become more attuned to it and more able to live in it. So I have actually a little more time than I was anticipating, so I'll just do the whole thing here. This is going to be a lot of spirituality. But if we think about the Christian life and this theme of egolessness, how might it manifest itself? This is a book by Beatrice Bruteau called Radical Optimism. She says, when we're having an experience that God is present and working through us as we're living our lives in the world, we not only do not take pride in what we do, but we are scarcely aware of ourselves as the ones who are doing. Interesting. The more we can make our eye single in this way and not let it divide into a double consciousness, partly on God's act of living and working through us, and partly a reflection on how well we're doing, the more our whole being, like the crystal, will be filled with the divine light. In this way, we gradually come to renounce our most fundamental habits of self-consciousness. So she's describing really the same dynamic that we saw with Flo, but now in a theological context, the context of Christian faith. And then union. What about this theme of union in the Christian life? One of the key principles of Catholic social teaching is the unity of the human family. Actually, that's why the popes, every time the Olympics roll around, emphasize, you know, the importance of Olympic things like the Olympic Games to remind us of our common humanity, unity of the human family. Bertheau says, the mystics of all traditions have always affirmed that in the ultimate view, we are all one. Somehow, each one's reality and highest good are intimately connected to each other one's reality and good. So I think, is it possible, you know, that a young person who starts to become aware that he or she is a part of something larger than himself by playing on a team has a glimpse of what it is? Bertheau says, you know, the mystics have intuited all along that we're one, that can start to, with God's grace, start to form the person into the future. Okay, this line of finger pointing to the moon, that comes from a Buddhist tradition. I'm thinking of maybe the flow experiences as along those lines, that are they something that are pointing to something that's important to pay attention to? Do they tell us something important about who we are and what we're made for? That we're made for a kind of joy, a kind of freedom, a kind of selflessness, and a kind of union with others? My concern is that we don't tend not to go this next step. When I was growing up, I had a dog, and I would throw the ball playing catch with the dog in the backyard, and the dog would just sit there, and so I would point to the ball, and then the dog would sniff my finger, you know? And sometimes I think we might be doing that with sport. We just become, we're sort of cable TV watching sports all the time, and we're kind of, you know, but we're not seeing what it's pointing to about the human person and what it is that we're made for. From a Christian perspective, God's grace enables the person of faith to experience these realities of joy, freedom, selflessness, and union at the most profound levels and even in relation to God. Thank you.
Like to thank Father Patrick for his knowledgeable reflections and insights into the topic. Please take a moment to write down your questions and then hold them in the air so that one of our volunteers can come around to pick them up. While we're doing that, we have some announcements. Our next First Friday Club luncheon will be here at Tangier on Friday, October 14th, with our ordinary Bishop Richard Lennon as our speaker. If you are listening to this podcast on our website, we invite you to join us in person. You can make reservations in three ways: by sending a check to the First Friday Club, you can call our phone number at 330-535-7668 each month. If you sign up on a monthly basis, let us know by the Tuesday before the Friday talk. And for those of you who are here, on the tables there are subscription sheets for our speaker series, offering a variety of subscription options. Please take a subscription form with you and consider making this speaker series a consistent part of your spiritual and intellectual growth. You can hear podcasts of our previous speakers by logging on to our website. Please consider recommending that to a friend as well. and you can keep up to date by joining us on Facebook. If you are not on our mailing list, please take time to fill out the orange cards on the tables so that we can add you to our email list and keep you up on our upcoming speakers. We would now like to recognize some special folks. If you are a first-time attendee, please wave or stand up for us. And we hope that you will be back. We also have some students here. If you students would all stand up now. We have students from Our Lady of the Elms, St. Vincent, St. Mary, Archbishop Hoban, Walsh Jesuit, and St. Mary's Elementary. Please welcome them. And I'd also like to recognize and ask the members of the First Friday Club of Greater Akron board members to please stand or wave. Now, are we ready for some questions? What can a coach do to cultivate flow?
I think it's really maybe helpful for coaches to remember why they started playing the game that they're coaching. And my guess is that it probably is because you love it and you enjoy it. And if you think of actually the best teachers or the best coaches are the ones who have such a great passion for what it is they're teaching about or coaching. And they want to communicate that to the kids. You know. So how's that connected to flow? Because it's about enjoyment. You know? That in the end, that's what you want to even, you know, and if we think we can't do it at the CYO level in eighth grade, can't emphasize that, or at the high school level. Even Phil Jackson says he's operating at a pretty high level. That the fundamental kind of job of a coach is to reconnect players with their love of the game. So now, more concretely, I think that it's possible to structure practices. This can happen in a classroom too. So that the kids are challenged in a way that is at their skill level and requires them to grow, where they're pushing the envelope. That's going to be enjoyable for the kids. You don't want to, you know, the first day of practice, put a much larger player, say a lineman or linebacker, up against a wide receiver too many times in a tackling drill. Because he's going to be overwhelmed and the challenge is too great and he's not going to come back to practice the next day. So that's a kind of an obvious example. But so can you structure even practices in such a way that the kids continue to develop their skills? It's at a challenge, you know, provides appropriate challenge so that they're engaged and in what it is they're doing.
Sports and money, can there be a balance?
Can there be a balance? I'm not sure does the question mean, can it be balanced? So in other words, because I teach at Seattle University, a lot of the students I teach are Division I student athletes. They're getting scholarships for playing sports. Phil Jackson's players get a lot of money, you know? So I think I think one of the things that happens in terms of sport itself and the experience that we need to be careful about is that the money doesn't become kind of the primary focus of a person's attention, or the fame. I'm drawing right now on Ignatius of Loyola, his two standards meditation. He thinks this is the way persons get off track. So, and Phil Jackson has a book called Sacred Hoops I recommend to you. He says, this is the dynamic that undermines his team, is when players start to get all caught up in the money and the fame. Because if you think about it, those are individual things, right? So I think in terms of what it is that corrupts, that might be a strong word, but what it is that undermines the activity in terms of its human significance, I think that's the kind of dynamic. Now, we have a similar problem in youth sport, because in the last 30 years or so, there's a dramatic rise in overuse injuries. And that dramatic rise is related to the fact that young people are specializing in one sport at earlier and earlier ages than they used to. When I was growing up, I played three sports. We were just all playing all the sports. Now it's more common for kids to specialize in one sport, but their bodies may not be, you know, mature enough to handle that kind of year-round training. And the numbers of kids in the literature on overuse injuries in sports, in youth sports, is really big. Now, just think, what is the mentality that's there? The mentality, I think, is that I want Susan or Johnny to get a leg up on the other kids so that they can get a college scholarship in this sport. So you see how it's sort of like a means to an end, or it becomes instrumentalized. The flow experiences, on the other hand, are enjoyable activities that we do for their own sake. Right? So now the other thing that's going on in youth sport is that dramatic numbers of kids are dropping out altogether when they're 12 or 13, right? So you have on the one hand this really serious training and sort of instrumental way of thinking, and then on the other hand you have other kids who dropping out. Number one reason is not fun anymore. So when Thomas Aquinas says that there can be sin in a lack of play, you know, I wonder if that might fit in our cultural context. And that sometimes even youth sport, the play element kind of can lead from that.
I think this questioner wants you to help him out. Your presentation is very understandable for team sports. What about golf? How does one gain more serenity?
Well, I don't claim expertise here. I've only golfed, I think, three times in my life. And it's probably because I was feeling the way he was feeling at some point. I guess I didn't have the skills for it at the time. I think some of these elements of flow would still also apply in team sports. You just don't have the whole, you know, the union with one's surroundings. It would also apply in individual sports, I mean. Centering of attention, egoless enjoyment would still be relevant. Sports are really kind of they're an interesting place where we can really learn about ourselves. I think, have you heard the Christian word asceticism, self-denial? That actually was first used by the Greeks. Ascesis was used in the context of athletic training, and the whole self-denial and discipline and et cetera. But I wonder, too, if we can learn something, we can learn important things about ourselves through the struggles that we have sometimes participating in sports, in a sport like golf, is it possible, for example, I noticed this about myself, actually. I think sometimes when I was playing sports, too, this would be the case. Sometimes when things don't go right, I could get so down on myself, you know? But I played free safety in college, you cannot be having a pity party, right? Just because something happens in the first quarter, you have to bounce back and be fully attentive to what's going on, because otherwise other things are going to go wrong. But I wonder if we can, in some ways, we can learn something about ourselves that can help us also in our lives. Because as we're living our lives in the course of family or work, or things don't always go the way that we want them to, you know? And maybe we can learn something about our reaction earlier in the context of sports. We learn something about ourselves. Okay, it doesn't really help me to become completely devastated by this, right? But is there a way I can sort of stop the bleeding and begin to kind of start to pay attention again? So I don't know. I'm just saying those kind of things in general. It could be that playing golf, you know, because of the frustrations of it and et cetera, could be that there's a lot going on that helps us to learn about ourselves and our lives more generally.
Did finding God in your athletic experience help call you to your vocation in the priesthood?
Yeah, I think so. I was talking to the Welsh students this morning, and the key is joy. That's the key to me. That's the key thing. And I did know joy when I was younger and participating in sports, and I knew, you know, what it meant to be a part of something larger than myself. And then one of the students asked about vocation, and key for me was a retreat I did. I think it was just after I was done playing football in college, where I had this with the judge, did it with the Jesuit, and I had this deep sense of joy and peace that seemed to be connected to entering the Jesuit novitiate. And then I continued to have those experiences, talking with spiritual director and prayer. And so then that's the way that I've gone. I experienced joy celebrating the liturgy, teaching. Those are challenges that I enjoy trying to meet, you know, and trying to develop the skill level to meet them. So it's similar. I think maybe it's similar, but also different, because when you're talking about Jesuit vocation, we're talking about the Holy Spirit. We're talking about it in a theological context. But I think, humanly speaking, I learned what joy was in important ways when I was participating in sport. And then, as you can see, I mean, I've been working in this area since I entered the Jesuit. So they kind of are coming together.
Again, I want to thank Father for his wonderful talk. And we wish you safe travels back home. I'd like to introduce Our Lady of the Elms student, Aaron Wagner, who will lead us in our closing prayer.
Let us pray. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you, Lord, for your presence with us this day and all days. Help us to be mindful of the words of wisdom shared by Father Kelly. Inspire us to take these words to heart and become examples of true Christians on the courts, fields, and at any sporting event. As we depart, we ask you to bless us throughout the remainder of the day and guide us safely home. Let the learning and conversations of this gathering continue to ruminate within us, all spectators, and our teams. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Again, we'd like to thank everyone for coming, and we look forward to seeing all of you here at Tangier next month on October 14th, when our speaker will be Bishop Richard Lennon. Thank you.